about searching for and hopefully finding the pigs. Pierre, not today, but Pierre got his PhD at the University of Montreal, was a postdoc at Toronto, and then on, you were a tramp scientist.
That's right.
At Toronto, and you were one of the, you worked on the Atlas collaboration. Mm-hmm. You were coordinator of the convener of the exotics group.
That's right. Right.
So this is in the middle of this, your territory. Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks a lot for coming.
Okay, thank you. I started out doing searches for exotic physics, but then I decided I would want to find something.
And so that's a good candidate. So in the last year, I've been working on this pretty much 100%. It was the topic of my PhD thesis, and I'll say a word about that later. So this is a colloquium that I'm giving. I realize that it's a different crowd here than if I go to some university where they don't necessarily even have particle physics. So the first 20 slides or so are mostly for undergrads so that they understand something, or at least graduate students too, so that they can follow. So I will go through those quickly. I may skip a few slides, and I'll spend more time on the status of our search with Atlas. Okay, so the big questions in particle physics, you're working, perhaps some of you, on some of those. I will focus on this one. What is mass, or what mechanism gives particles their mass, at least in the standard model? And there are a bunch of other interesting questions that we're tackling. What is dark matter? So we're looking for it at the LHC, and there are other things that we're doing, but today we'll focus on the Higgs. So this is a representation of all the particles that have been found, and we've seen them all, even the tau neutrino at the end of the 90s when I was at Fermilab. So we've found all of these, but we're missing, as you know, one particle, and that's the Higgs boson. Of course, the standard model doesn't say anything about gravity or this potential dark matter particle, but it does predict a Higgs boson. So we're going after it. And so here's an introduction from the fundamental forces, and I'll skip it and just go through a few little things. So one thing that you know is that there are three massive bosons, and that this creates a problem for renormalizability, and you need to find a way of giving those boson mass, and that is done by the Higgs mechanism. So maybe I'll skip this. We can come back later if you're just interested in how, you know, I would present this topic to a general audience. I usually go through, you know, what spontaneous symmetry breaking looks like, for instance, in a ferromagnet, you know, with everything aligning. So here, the average magnetization is zero. Once you cool down your piece of rock, for instance, that would be a ferromagnet, then the state of lowest energy is one where all the little magnets align. But there's nothing in your theory that says, you know, you must point in a certain direction, this direction or that direction. The state of lowest energy requires you to pick a direction. So this is illustrated here. So you could think of this phi parameter here as the average magnetization. When your piece of rock is hot, you cool it down, and then the lowest energy requires that you pick a direction so that they all align. And it's similar for our Higgs field. So the lowest energy is one where we pick a value for this field in the vacuum that's not zero. Okay, and there's an analogy with the Meissner effect, and we have an illustration of this here. So this could be a piece of superconductor or a magnet, and it depends which one is which. We have a nice little display at the University of Toronto where we have a little train that goes around the track, and our superconductor is sitting on the train. And what's happening here is that the magnetic field lines cannot go through this piece of magnet. And there's an interesting analogy between what happens here and what would happen with this Higgs mechanism. So what's happening here is you've got pairs of electrons, or Cooper pairs, that condensate between, you know, below a certain temperature, and typically that will be between, say, 0 and 100 Kelvin. And this condensate is disturbed by the electromagnetic field, or photons, so it doesn't let photons go through. On the high-energy physics side, you have a Higgs condensate. And so the Higgs condenses below some temperature, which is much larger, 10 to the 15 Kelvins. And this condensate is then disturbed by the weak bosons. So what happens in the superconductor that we have here is that it leads to a short-range force. So if you've got some electromagnetic field inside, it has an attenuation length. It's quite small, 10 to the minus 6 centimeters. And this leads to the photon effectively acquiring a mass. On the high energy physics side, we also have a short range force. And the attenuation length here is much smaller, 10 to the minus 16 centimeters. And the W and Z bosons then acquire a mass. So maybe you've read before that maybe we live in a superconductor, and that's what the idea is. And so this is the generic picture. So at very early in the universe, you've got some massless electroweak bosons and sort of a Higgs field. And then you have this breaking of the symmetry, and you get a non-zero value here for V. And then you get the physical bosons after that we are familiar with. So the photon remains massless, the W and the Z boson acquire mass. And it also predicts an extra boson, a scalar boson, and that's the particle that we haven't yet found. Okay, so the standard model answers this question about what's mass with the Higgs mechanism, and it predicts a fundamental scalar particle. And so we'll need to find it or exclude it. So this is the search phase, and that's what we're doing right now. And then, if we find something, we really want to determine if it is the standard model Higgs and not something else. And maybe that's the, you know, phase two, where we try to characterize what it is that we found. One prediction is that the coupling of the Higgs to particles determines their mass. And so we'd like to measure those couplings to various particles to check the theory. And, current measurements, even if you haven't seen the Higgs yet, are sensitive to the potential presence of the Higgs boson. So to be politically correct, I've added the names of some of the, I mean, even omitting some, but that have contributed to this mechanism, including Anderson and maybe some Russian undergrads, I was told recently in the talk by Frank Close at the U of T, and more recently, I don't know if you've heard about that, but that at Morion, the big winter conferences, the speakers were asked not to mention the Higgs boson, but call it, you know, something else, BEH, for Broughton Englert, and I think he was in the audience. And then, you know, I think Mr. Goralnik is not necessarily happy, because he did have some boson with a mass zero, but whatever. Whereas these guys didn't, anyway. So people are, I guess, looking on Expedia for first-class tickets to Stockholm or something. But I think, so the Atlas speaker called it the scalar, standard model scalar boson. I hope we don't have to do that. I will keep calling the Higgs boson, personally. I don't have a problem adding a bunch of names to the mechanism, though. But especially for Feynman diagram, you know, we'll keep the H. So I got this latest fit to electroweak observables. This is from March 2012. And so this includes a bunch of effects, the latest W mass measurement, et cetera. And it shows you essentially what is the best fit when you consider everything. And it's around 95 GeV or so. But within one sigma, you can go out roughly to 130 GeV. OK, so there's no real tension here. And here I basically explain why virtual particles can affect the particle's mass. When I was an undergrad, the top quark had not been measured. But I remember my phenomenology professor said the top quark's mass is 150 plus or minus 25. That was around the beginning of the 90s. And the reason was that we had LEP started, we had a very good measurement of the Z boson mass, and we had also a decent measurement of the W mass from the UA2 experiment and experiments at CERN and even Fermilab. And so the masses of the particles that are in the loops will affect the masses of those particles and the properties also. And so the ratio of the Z mass to the W mass is sensitive to the top mass. This thing is quite heavy. It's a big difference between having two very heavy things here and just one. And so that's how you could predict the top mass. Now you can play the same game because now the top mass is extremely well measured for a quark. And a W mass now is down to 15 MeV or so when you combine everything. And so you can play the same game and put the Higgs in the loop, and this is essentially what you get. It tells you that the Higgs is light, and you know within plus or minus maybe let's say 100 plus or minus 25 or so. And maybe I'll skip that. I'll assume that you know why we built the LHC. Okay, that's another thing you know, but I'll mention it anyway. The Higgs boson mass is sort of unstable. So what we were just discussing is the contribution of virtual particles to its mass are comparable to the energy of the virtual particles. Okay, so this is true for the Higgs. And so there's no limit to how much energy you can put in there, and that creates a problem. So the Higgs does not want to be light. It would like to be, at least in the standard model, as heavy as possible. And if we try to extend the standard model to very high energies, then keeping the mass small requires very precise fine-tuning. So we say that the theory is unnatural. Now, many solutions have been proposed to this problem. In general, they involve new physics at the weak scale. So supersymmetry solves this by adding particles that contribute an opposite sign. So you solve this problem. Or if you want more exotic solutions, you could say that you know, you don't need to go to the 10 to the 19 GeV. The Planck scale is really at the TeV scale, so you can't extend it farther. But I won't discuss this today. So a few words about the Large Hadron Collider. So it's a big machine, 26 kilometers long in Geneva. It collides protons and protons at a center of mass of 7 and now 8 TeV, so 7 TeV for since 2008. And now, as you saw at the beginning of the talk, they've raised the energy by 1 TeV. They think they can do that safely this year. And the collisions happen every 50 nanoseconds. So this is not the design interval. The design interval is 25 nanoseconds. And it makes a difference because we've built our calorimeters with 25 nanoseconds in mind. And also, 25 nanoseconds allows you to have more collisions and less pileup. And so we're in a situation now where we'll be running with high pileup. So the machine produces up to 300 to 700 million collisions per second. So 700 million is what we're anticipating in the coming months. And so it's going to produce, what this means is every bunch crossing, you get about 35 at the beginning of the fill, 35 collisions. And originally, the experiments were designed for 20. So full luminosity at high energy was going to be 20. So we're going above that. And at some level, this is a good thing because I spent 10 years on the Tevatron before, and we had quite a bit of trouble going up to high luminosity. This is not a problem for the LHC. Now it's a problem for the experimentalists. We need to deal with that, and it's quite a challenge. In 2011, so those are the results that I'll be showing today, there was a huge rise in the number of events that we have in our data set, 150 times. So that's not going to happen again this year. This year, we hope to increase our data set by a factor of 4, maybe 3 to 4. The good thing, it's 3 to 4, but because we're running at 8 TeV, it makes a huge difference if you're looking for very high mass states, and it makes a non-negligible difference if you're looking for a Higgs. So we're talking about 20 to 30% increase in the cross-section for producing Higgses. So every inverse femtobarn, you know, you can multiply by a factor of 1.3 for this year. And we hope to reach 13 or 14 TeV. This depends on training 1,200 magnets around this ring. But 13 would be great in sometime in 2014. So I learned yesterday that there was an additional delay in when we would come back in 2014. So right now, the plan is to run this year in 2012, and then have a 1.5 year or so shutdown to repair the machine so that it can go to high energy. And CMS has asked to an extra 2 months, it seems, that's been agreed. So we would come back in September 2014. Takes a while for the machine to do all its tests, so we may be thinking about 2015. One thing I should mention, though, about the plans for this year is that they intend to run until this Higgs question is settled. And so normally they stop for the holiday break in December, and we come back in March or April like we're doing now. And one reason is that it's quite expensive in Switzerland to run this machine in the middle of the winter. The electricity rates go up. But they said that they would run until they, you know, we see something or we exclude the Higgs. Now you may wonder, you know, why so many collisions per second? And this tells you a little bit why. So the total cross section is roughly 10 to the 10 here. Okay, so you get another 5 or 6 orders of magnitude above this. So when the two protons collide and you see something, you're 5 orders of magnitude above that. For jets that we are worried about that can fake leptons or photons, we're talking about 10 to the 8. And our Higgs signal, depending where we're looking for it, is here, you know, between, say, 0.1 and 10. Okay, so we have a lot of background. And the backgrounds that we worry about are W plus jet production. And these are measurements that have been made, and Z, and TOP, which is kind of interesting because when I started at Fermilab, you know, we were trying really, really hard to see as many dileptron events from TOP as we could. And now for our analysis, we're trying to keep it out, and it just seeps in from all corners, and it's very hard to get rid of this pest that used to be my signal. And T here is single TOP, WW, irreducible background, and then you get down to, okay, so we will worry about all these things. Okay, so the ATLAS detector is nicely situated near the entrance of CERN, so we don't need to go like 13 kilometers around to get to it like CMS. And it's about 100 meters down. And here's a picture of the tunnel when they were making the interconnections that will need to be fixed. So basically, every 10 meters, you need to open this up and fix it. Yeah. So it's going to 1,200 times. So it's going to take a while. And this is a picture of the big ATLAS detector. And the reason we're close to the entrance is that the hole in the ground that you need to dig needs to be, well, need to support the Earth around it. And at the other end, you couldn't. So CMS is smaller. They get to go at the other end. And we're near. And this is the size of people to set the scale. This is a standard collider detector, except that it's big. It has a magnetic spectrometer at the center right here. And everything in there is aligned to a few tens of microns. And then we have the calorimeters to measure the energy of the particles. And most of what you see is actually a big muon system, a big muon spectrometer that produces a toroidal field. So this is a solenoid. You know, the field lines are going along the beam, and the toroid is going all around. Okay, so this is a picture of ATLAS without the calorimeter. And this is a picture with the calorimeter in me. And the reason I kept this picture is that my PhD project was designing this thing. And another thing that you don't see inside is the forward calorimeter. And those are important for some of our Higgs searches. So the prime design consideration for this calorimeter, which was built in Canada and Calgary and Triumph, and the forward was built in Toronto and Carleton. And the prime design consideration was that we could see those jets that I'll show you what they are later, coming from Higgs production, so we could tag them when we have high luminosity. And I left after that. I didn't see any of this. I spent 10 years on CDF, and I came back 10 years later, and there was this gigantic hole in the ground, and the thing that I had, you know, in simulations was real. And that sort of sets the scale, right, in terms of time, because I, as a grad student, I was running Higgs simulation for the LHC, and then I went away, did different things like top physics or whatever. And then I come back, and many years later, now we can take data. So it takes almost a half a career to do that. This is a picture of our magnetic spectrometer, and this becomes a very important part of our searches now, because when you have a lot of pileup, like this year, you will be putting 35 collisions within about, you know, a few centimeters, maybe 6 centimeters. And what we want to do is identify that the interesting leptons that we think are from a Higgs collision come from, you know, collision number 13 right here, and associate the jets, again, point them back to this particular vertex. And the pixel detector that you have here is very useful in being able to identify one vertex and another. So you couldn't do that, for instance, with CDF. Here's another picture of the solenoid magnet. So our entire tracker fits in there. This is a picture of the tracker. And this is a picture of another piece of the magnet. So for the muon, so you have 8 of those that were trucked in at some point. Okay, here's a picture of a collision, and just to set the scale, somebody there, but of course nobody's there when we collide the beams. They would die. If we just look at just a slice of, say, a collision like this, this is, you know, experimental physics for undergrads or grad students that are not familiar. We use our tracker here to measure the momentum of particles. And so the straighter they are, the higher the momentum. And for the energy measurement, we use an electromagnetic calorimeter to measure electrons and photons. And we use both the electromagnetic and hadronic calorimeters to measure the energies of protons, pions, neutrons, etc. And then muons will tend to go through the entire calorimeter. And so we make another magnetic momentum measurement in a different magnetic field out there. So it's a kind of a complicated trajectory for the muon, because it starts out, you know, if you've got a collision like this, it will bend in this way for the inner tracker, and then it goes to the calorimeter, and then it bends another way once it hits the toroids. And so what we try to do is associate, you know, this track and combine the two measurements to be as precise as we can. Maybe I'll skip this. This tells you how we measure particle masses. If you make momentum measurements and energy measurements and you've got an initial particle, you know, all you need to do is take, say, one electron and an anti-electron that you've measured, you combine them together. And this is an example, for instance, of an event where you Z candidate decays to 2 muons. And so those particles went through the entire detector and were measured in the magnetic spectrometer. And so this is something that anybody can do, is if I give you file that has those four vectors. You combine them together and you make a mass plot. This is what you would see, a nice little resonance. And this is a nice thing for undergrads to do. We can also look at what happens at lower masses, and then you see interesting features like the JSI particle, and then the upsilons, the Z. And of course, we're looking at what happens, you know, at higher energies. And we haven't seen a Z-like particle up until 2TeV now. Okay, another important thing is how we measure particles that do not interact with neutrinos, and that's essentially by conservation of momentum. So if this guy is a neutrino, we can infer that a neutrino went there just by calculating the transverse momentum of everything around it. It becomes a bit more complicated when you have two neutrinos, say this is a neutrino and this is another neutrino, because you cannot determine where the neutrinos went. You only know what is the vector product of the two, the vector sum, I should say, of the two. Right? And so for some of the analyses that I'll describe, this is what happens. All right, so now I'll start discussing a bit more Higgs production, Higgs decays, et cetera. So at the LHC, the dominant production mechanism is through gluon fusion, where you have two gluons that will not couple to the Higgs because they're massless, but through the strong force, they can couple to quarks. And the Higgs likes heavy particles, so for all practical purposes, the top is the relevant particle in this loop. And so for this production process, this coupling of the Higgs to top, which is large, which is essentially one, is relevant. The next production mechanism is weak boson fusion. It's shown here. At low masses, it's about an order of magnitude less than the dominant production mechanism. The advantage here that I alluded to before are that you get two extra quarks. So what's happening is you've got two quarks that are, two protons that are coming in, or quarks. They emit, each emit a W, so they get a little bit of a PT kick, and they keep going. So they tend to go in the opposite hemispheres and in a forward region. Okay, so we tried to identify these jets that are very forward and have about half of the PT of the W or the Z boson here. Okay, so this is an interesting channel because you're measuring the coupling to the weak bosons in this case. And next up, at low mass, still, it depends where you're looking for, but this has a low cross section, so this is QQ bar producing a W or a Z, and then you have a Higgs that's associated here with the W. So here again, you have a coupling to the W or the Z boson. Okay, so as far as decays are concerned, once you pick a mass, you know exactly how the Higgs is supposed to behave. So it's very predictive, and that's quite nice. So this parameter is determined already. We know what V is. And once we set the Higgs mass, in principle, we have a value for this parameter lambda, which is relevant for the potential. So this potential is a question for the LHC because it involves measuring the triple coupling of Higgs together. So you have one Higgs going to Higgs. And it will be very, very challenging for the LHC experiments to go after this parameter. Once you have the Higgs mass, you know what to look. So that might be one reason why you would like to build a linear collider, could make precision measurements of the Higgs triple coupling or quartic coupling. So here I have the decays on two scales, and maybe I'll focus on this one, because essentially, you know, as you'll see, we've eliminated pretty much all of this range. So you look at how things decay in the low mass range. I've put a line here around 125 where we've seen some hints. And it's kind of interesting because here, as you can see, you hit a bunch of different particles, right? It's not zero. You're at the maximum of gamma-gamma, You have Taos, and you have BB Bar, and WW and ZZ, right? So if we were at 180, the situation would be quite different. We would probably be only able to measure ZZ and WW, and sort of then indirectly infer the coupling of top, but that would be it. It would be almost impossible to look into, well, could always do BB Bar, but very difficult. So it's an interesting place to be, but at the same time, these measurements, as you'll see, are very challenging. So the good news is it's not impossible to make these measurements, but they're hard to do. Had we been somewhere else, it might have been impossible. So this is the a plot of the Higgs width with respect as a function of mass on the x-axis here. And for low values, you see that the width is very small, like less than 1% or so. And that means from an experimental perspective that the resolution is really determined by the experiment and not the Higgs itself. Once you go up to 500 GeV, then you know you're hitting about 100 GeV of width. It's barely a particle anymore, and we can do better with our experimental resolution than 100 GeV. And what this means also from a design perspective is you really want to push at pace to have very good calorimeters or very good trackers to measure the Higgs mass precisely. On this plot here, that I show you the sigma times branching ratio because it's a little bit more informative, tells you how many events you end up with. Okay, so if you look around, I don't know, 120, 130, you'll see that some channels dominate, like WW, LNU, QQ. What this plot doesn't tell you is the background. And for this channel, we can't do much. And so although it's producing most of the events, it's kind of hopeless at low mass. And after that, you see that the Higgs to tau tau is not negligible. It's pretty large, but this too has a large background. And this is followed by WW going to 2 leptons and 2 neutrinos. So in principle, this is clean, because at a hadron collider, you want to see many leptons in the final state, and you have 2 neutrinos that can give you missing momentum, missing transverse energy. And so this is a powerful search channel, as you'll see. And a few other things that I want to point out is ZZ going to 4 leptons. So this one produces very few events. Sort of a golden channel, though. It's very, very clean, almost no background. But you need integrated luminosity. You need data to just see 1 or 2 events. Right? But it's very, very clean. OK, so what was the situation when we started looking for the Higgs? So it basically looked like this. The Tevatron had excluded a little bit around 160 GeV. And as far as the standard model Higgs was concerned, we had a 40 GeV window left to look for the Higgs. So there were some limits from LEP and the Tevatron. And of course, we want to look here because we don't know what's out there. But from the point of view of the standard model, we expect it to be in this range. And so after the 2010 run, these are the limits that we were able to set. And you see that we were not in the game yet, but we were exercising all the tools. And the situation changed really dramatically last summer around lepton photon, where this line moved below 1. So 1 means that every time this dark line goes below 1, you're excluding the standard model at 95% confidence level. And so in the summer of 2011, then we were excluding, you know, hundreds of GeV of phase space for the Higgs. And we went beyond the Tevatron. And what I'm going to show you now are the results from, this month, from Morion. And for Atlas, we basically finally had results with the full data set for all of the channels. So our competitors, CMS, had preliminary results for all of those last December. And it took us a bit more time to do the same thing for all our results. So the two important ones were available in December, but a lot of other interesting ones were just shown a few weeks ago. Okay, so what I'm going to show you here are the expected exclusion sensitivities. So in the last, you could go back to 20 years, there were strategies for looking for the Higgs boson, and this has evolved quite a bit. But until you get the data, you don't really know how sensitive you are. You know, we look at various control regions in the data, we find out that yes, we do understand this background, no, we did not understand this background, et cetera. So what you see here is our expected sensitivities, but based on what we know about our analyses. And these are quite different than what we thought things would look like 3 years ago. So the most sensitive channel in the interesting range for the standard model is this red curve here, which is W going to two leptons and two neutrinos. And it's the most sensitive down to about 120 or 120 something. And then after that, Higgs gamma kicks in right here. And you see that this search channel is really focused on the low mass range. And our golden channel, ZZ to four leptons, excludes, you know, takes over around 200 GeV and then contributes quite a bit at higher masses. And then over here, we sort of cross two other channels, so tau tau and BB bar at around 120. So we're in an interesting, again, situation where at the low interesting mass, we need to combine all of these channels. And even though, you know, some are more sensitive than the others, they all contribute. Okay, it's basically only here in this region where WW completely dominates everything else. But everywhere else, we're using many different channels to achieve this exclusion. Okay, so what was missing from our ATLAS results were this one, the supposedly most sensitive one we had not shown before, and BB bar and tau. Okay, so I'm going to say a word about all these channels in turn. So this WW star LNU, its production depends on the coupling to the top quark, at least in the standard model. You can put other particles in there if you want, but in the standard model, it's the top quark, and then the decay depends on its coupling to WW. So it has the best exclusion sensitivity over most of the low mass range, as we saw, but it's a challenging final state as you go below 140 GeV because W mass is 80, and so one of them becomes virtual, or both of them even sometimes. And so what happens is you've got two neutrinos that that you need to deal with, and that degrades the Higgs mass resolution. So you cannot have a good mass resolution with this channel. As you go to lower and lower masses, then one of the leptons and one of the neutrinos starts to get softer and softer and softer, and so that means larger backgrounds. We rely on a good understanding of the missing ET resolution here, and this becomes harder and harder as you increase the pileup, as we'll see in a second. So the other challenge is that many small backgrounds need to be estimated. And they may be small, but the signal contribution is small. So you need to understand many, 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 many things. And maybe you know, we'll get some help from some of you guys pretty soon in the next few months, or at least some guidance on how to deal with these small backgrounds. So this channel is sensitive to pileup. It was a big difference when we went from 5 collisions per crossing in the last summer, and then last fall we went to 15 or so maximum, and that impacted this analysis, and now we go to 35. And so the sensitivity for this channel will probably go down relative to the others this year. Higgs gamma gamma is quite a nice channel. It depends on the coupling to the top quark again. But you can also, we can also look at the vector boson fusion if we want. And the rate is smaller, but the CMS has done that, and we're doing that too. And then the decay depends on the double your coupling, or the you can also put the top here, right? Because the top is charged, so can emit photons. The EM calorimeter of ATLAS was designed with this signal in mind, so it's kind of nice that we're looking for it there, right? If it was at higher masses, it wouldn't be useful, but we're right where we want to be, I guess. It's a good discovery, final state, because we just have to reconstruct the invariant mass of the two photons, and the mass resolution is excellent. You're also looking for a resonance on top of a smooth background, which is a huge advantage. So the previous channel, you need to calculate, you know, five or six backgrounds, and you worry about them. If you get this wrong, any of them wrong by a factor of two, it has a big impact. You know, you're screwed up, basically. Here, if you're wrong by a factor of two, it doesn't matter. It just means that the signal, you know, you're either more sensitive or less sensitive, but you're looking at the background because you're looking at the sidebands. So you can't really go wrong. So it's also quite robust with respect to pileup. And that's an advantage with respect to the other channels in 2012. Okay, Higgs to four leptons. Again, this is the main production mechanism. I don't list the VBF here because there's just no rate. There are no events to be found, just a few. The decay depends on the coupling to the Z. It has a small branching fraction to the four lepton final state, which is why you need high luminosity. It's a good discovery final state because it has almost no background, very good Higgs mass resolution again. However, on the experimental side, you need to try to get those events, right? And so if you have some efficiency, say 70% efficiency for reconstructing one lepton, well, you know, it's 0.7 times to the fourth power. And so we spend a lot of time increasing as much as we can the efficiency. And it's a clear and robust signal of the couplings of Higgs to weak boson. So if we can see a peak there, that's great. Next up is Higgs to BB bar. And here we're looking for it in the associated production channel. The decay then depends on the coupling to the B quark, which is important because you would like to measure, you know, a coupling to a few fermions. You can go with the top, you can go with B, and maybe tau, and that's it. We're lucky to be in a situation where we have some hope of measuring these things at all. Now, it's a small production cross-section, but the branching ratio is not small, so that's not the problem of this analysis. The problem is the very challenging final state with huge W plus jet backgrounds. So, you know, production of a one vector boson plus BB bar is much higher than this channel. And so what you want is a very good B tagging efficiency. Okay, try to get as many events as you can. And you want to try to optimize the resolution, but it, you know, it's not going to be as good as two photons or two leptons because you're dealing with jets and the resolutions are just not that good. Okay, then Higgs to tau tau, that's another important channel because it's maybe our only hope of measuring the Higgs coupling to a lepton. Maybe, you know, after 3,000 inverse femtobarns, we can go for muons. Maybe we don't know that we can do that, but the tau, maybe. Now the cross-section times branching ratio is relatively high, as I showed, so that's good. But again, you have very large backgrounds to deal with. I'll show you an example in a minute. And the worry for 2012 is that it's also quite sensitive to pileup. So that's an extra challenge in 2012. Okay, I'll say a few give you a few more details about some of those analyses. So what I show here is the missing ET distribution, something call ET misrel because there's a relative angle that's taken into account between a missing ET and a lepton. But for all practical purposes, you can just think of this as missing momentum. And what you see is a huge Drellian background, so Z plus jets, you know, that sort of decaying exponentially. And the red here is the signal. And so what we do to get rid of Drellian is we increase this cut on missing ET rel, and then we need to deal about with what's left. But what's causing this slope is just the detector resolution. We can lose jets or not measure them. You know, they can go in cracks, or they can fluctuate in such a way that they're not well measured. And the problem when you increase the missing the number of interactions is that this resolution gets worse. And so this slope basically, you know, does this and flattens out. So what it means for us this year is instead of having, you know, this slope, we'll get a different slope, a lot more Drellian background. We need to worry about that and get rid of it. On the right-hand side, you have the distribution of jets in the Higgs events in the background. So we get most of our events in what we call a zero jet bin, when there's no jets. And you see that in that bin, the largest background is the WW standard model production background. And then when you go to a higher jet bins, then the top quark dominates. Now, you know, a few years ago, not that long ago, in 2004, we did everything we could to get 28 events. And here we've already tried to get rid of them at some level, and you see we have thousands. So we're looking, you know, for vector boson fusion searches, so a pure coupling of vector bosons. You're sitting on top of this huge background. Okay, so so the event selections will exploit specific kinematic features in the angular distribution of the Higgs decay. So the Higgs is a scalar. And so if it decays to W plus W minus, you need to spin a total to be zero. And what this means, because of the V minus A interaction, is that the two leptons are going in the same direction. Okay, and the two neutrinos are going the same direction, so that's good. So what we require is that the angle between the two leptons, or the invariant mass, we require it to be small. Interestingly, if we do see a signal with WW, this is just because of our cuts. It's a good sign that it's a scalar, it's a zero. Because if you've got a, well, if you see it in photon-photon, you know it's not a spin one, so it could be spin zero or spin two. And if it's spin two, then our cuts basically reject a spin two particle. So if we see it there, we've basically measured the spin with the photon-photon. The main backgrounds are estimated using control regions. In fact, just about all our backgrounds are controlled, if you will, by looking at different regions of phase space. Where this is one example. You know, to reject top, we ask that there be no jets that are tagged, and so we can reverse that cut and normalize ourselves, right? And so when we do that, you see that it's completely dominated by top. And we have different selections for WW, so we ask that there be no jets and that the invariant mass between the two leptons be large. And so there's essentially no signal left, and it's dominated by WW. And the way we do all this in a big fit is that you know, the TT bar contribution is fitted here, but this is reflected also in here, and WW is also reflected in here. And it continues like this for most of the backgrounds. So what we do to identify the signal in the end is we reconstruct a transverse mass that's defined like this. So unlike a W boson, where you have only one electron, you don't get a nice sharp edge. You get something that's quite wide. So I don't know if you can see, but in red here, you have the Higgs signal. And you, as you'll see, it's quite different than gamma-gamma for the resolution. Okay, so we're looking for this with all this background. Okay, and this is for a mass of 125. What is worrying us, and maybe you can tell, is we're not necessarily worried about WW. We're more worried about this blue thing. This blue thing is W plus jet, so fakes. It's very hard to, you can't get that from simulation. It's difficult to measure this precisely, and it has the same shape as our signal. And so what is limiting the sensitivity of this search is the fact that it this background looks a lot like Higgs, and there's a big systematic uncertainty associated with it. Okay, so for some results with four inverse femtobarns, the observed exclusion goes between 130 and 260, while the expected is 127 to 234. So overall, it looks pretty consistent with the standard model everywhere. And as you'll see, a peak in the next few slides around 125, there's not much of a peak here. However, this is the best fit, if you will, for how much signal there is there. You know, there's a little bit of signal, and it's not inconsistent with zero. It's not inconsistent with one. So it's hard to judge. For gamma-gamma, so this is a small signal with enormous backgrounds. But here we, like I said, this calorimeter was designed to basically deal with this. The signal is about 0.04 picobarns, and you need to deal with an irreducible background that's much larger, 30 inverse picobarns. You can get jets to fake a photon, and that's many orders of magnitude larger. And so photon identification is crucial. So we need to be able to tell a pi zero here, where you see two energy deposits, because it decayed to two photons with respect to a photon. Okay, I think I'll skip some of the details here, except to say that the resolution is around 2 GeV. So it's very good at 120 GeV. And the way that the analysis is done is it's separated into many categories, depending on whether the photon converted or where it went in the calorimeter. Okay, and here's an event display of a candidate event where you have two photons, so there are no high PT tracks. High PT track is something that would be straight pointing to it. And here's an example of a conversion candidate where, you know, two tracks start after interacting with some material in a silicon detector. So the background, like I said, can be evaluated using either the data or the Monte Carlo. But in the end, this is just an evaluation of what we think the composition is of the background. You see, it's dominated by the irreducible gamma-gamma, and then you have some component from gamma plus jet, and then jet-jet. But this, our knowledge of these components is not important, because in the end, what we try to do is basically fit this to a shape that we think will fit in all these categories. And we look for a bump. And there's a bit of a bump right here. And this is expressed in terms of, again, the limit plot, 95% confidence level. So we can essentially, normally we would expect not to rule out anything at this point, but there are a few lucky exclusions, and those are to be expected. What's also to be expected are some bumps the other way, but there's a relatively a big one here at around 125. I'll tell you how significant it is in a second. So the observed local significance, this is what is produced. So this is how what's the probability that the background-only hypothesis would produce a bump like this at a particular value is about 2.8 sigma. And then you can take into account the fact that you're looking over a very wide spectrum. That's called the look-elsewhere effect. And if we take into account that this search is looking between 110 and 150, then the significance is much less, 1.5. And here you see the best, again, fit for a signal, and one would correspond to the standard model. And you see that it's higher, actually, than the standard model, but not inconsistent. Also see that at other places, it would also be consistent with the standard model. OK, I think I'll skip this one. Now, for Z to 4 leptons, what I show you here are the resolutions for 130 GeV, for ZZ going to 4 electrons and 4 muons. And again, the resolution is about 2 GeV. So it's excellent. We select four leptons. So two of them are relatively high, 20 GeV, and then two leptons that are soft, because one of them can be a Z star. So it depends here where you're looking for your Higgs. If you're above 180 GeV, then you have four high PT leptons. But as you go lower, at least one of the two Z bosons will not reconstruct a Z boson. So this is shown here. So if you take the pair that's closest to the Z boson mass, we call it M12, you have this distribution. And here you have also the same thing. And then you have this this tail, okay, where the Z is no longer on shell. Okay, so this is a distribution of the events. Overall, in the search range, you see 62, you observe 71, you predicted 62, so this is kind of consistent. When you look at where the events show up, you might see some excess around here, and that's 124. We have three events at 124, and maybe another excess here. And here are a couple of event displays showing the leptons coming out. So four, I think here's four muons, because they go through the muon chambers. And then two electrons and two muons. Okay, so for the Z, you see again that you know, you have various wiggles. You have one. Did I miss it? Okay, so you have one around 124 that we saw before. You have another one here that goes maybe into the white. So this is the two sigma band. Okay, so overall, when you consider the whole range, it turns out that these fluctuations that we see are consistent with what you would expect. You know, if you're not looking at what the other experiment is doing or what your other search channels look like, these fluctuations are to be expected. Okay, so some results for Higgs to tau tau and BB. So these are not sensitive yet to set exclusion limits, but they do make an impact on the combined limits in the end. So you see that the expected exclusion is about, I don't know, three or four times the standard model in the low mass range. This is for tau tau. And this is for Higgs to BB and Z to BB. So about five or four times, an interesting region. What you also see is that things are relatively consistent, so pretty much within the one sigma band, right? So no excess yet. And I think I'll skip these two. This is just to show you that it's challenging to do these searches for BB, because this is the channel that you're looking for, and it's multiplied by five here for Z. Right? And here it's multiplied by five for W. So we're not quite there. So for the overall combination, I've got four plots. So this shows the whole search range that goes from 110 to over 600. And you see that we've basically excluded everything in this region. The region that is not excluded is are at low mass. You see we have so this is one, right? So we exclude up to 115. We have another exclusion here, and then the bump. So this goes into the 120 or something like that. When you put everything together and you ask what's the best fit for a standard model Higgs, you see that it gives you about, it's consistent with one, a little bit below. So what is different than the last results are that the new channels that we added basically brought down this excess that was above one, and now it's a little bit below. But in both cases, it's still consistent with one. Yep. Okay, so numerically, you have the observed exclusion here with a little window around 117 or 118 that's not excluded. And then we go up from 129 to 539. And what we expected to exclude, this is wrong. This is 555, 120 to 550. So we could have excluded the Higgs last year, you know, with a little bit of luck. but we didn't because we got this this bump. Now, for the combination, the minimum local p-value, when you add everything together, gives you an excess of 2.5 sigma. And then you can convert that into some global probability. So if you want this, if you want the full mass range, it would be 30%, which isn't very large. If you want to look between 110 and 146, then it's 10%. So the only thing that's clear, you know, mathematically from a statistics point of view is this one. Here, what you pick for your range is arbitrary, depends on the person. So to answer this question, where's the standard model Higgs? There's 6 GeV left. So if you believe in the standard model and the Higgs, we've essentially measured its mass already quite well, right, to within plus or minus 3 GeV at 125. And if you add CMS, it's even less. So less than 5, so they exclude another GeV here. Okay, so what about other experiments? I've got maybe 5 minutes, is that okay? Am I running a little long or? Okay, sorry about that. So for the other experiments, here you have the results from CMS. And this is expressed as the best fit, so sigma over sigma standard model. And you see that their gamma-gamma result is well above 1, for one thing. And pretty much all the others are consistent with 0 and 1. So we can't really tell. And this is their the equivalent of their best fit. And you see that over quite a bit of range here, it's still consistent with this bump at 125. Now, the interesting thing about the CMS results is that they this bump at 125 is really driven by gamma-gamma alone. They don't have the ZZ events. ZZ is the red here. Okay, so they do have something, but it's at sort of a different mass. Okay, because the resolutions are quite good, you know, we can resolve, for instance, the difference between 120 or 121 and 125. So this bump is not the same as this one. Finally, recently, the Tevatron combined their results from D0 and CDF, and they also got some excess in the region between 110 and 150. Again, here you don't have the kind of mass resolution that you expect for gamma-gamma. They were looking for the associated production that we discussed before. Okay, I'll skip this. This was from 2007, thinking that the Tevatron would find the Higgs before the LHC. It turns out the jet car actually will probably win that race. So what is next? So in the next few weeks, we start collecting data again at a higher energy. We could double our data set for the summer conferences. We're still in the search phase, so we need to see if the observe excess increases. And now, you know, this look elsewhere effect that I discussed is essentially gone. So we know where what's left. We've got 5 GeV left. We need to see, in particular, if ZZ and maybe WW, those two channels, also see significant excess. I've got a bet with one of my UFT colleagues about this, the theorist. So he really does not want to see ZZ or WW. He says he'll retire if we see an excess in ZZ, and he retires, I get a bottle of wine. We need to confirm with CMS. And if the excess is confirmed, then we change gears. So then we start asking the question, OK, what is it exactly? And then some of the channels that you said are not really interesting because, you know, you can't say anything, blah, blah, blah. Well, they become very interesting now because those are the channels that you want to measure. And you try to see something. Is it consistent with the standard model Higgs? And this is a very interesting experimental challenge. It's very difficult. But there are 3,000 of us, so hopefully we'll do it. And we will be looking for discrepancies. So if we rule out this the standard model Higgs, then a new search begins. So all channels, again, become interesting, especially WWZZ in particular. So we go back and then we try to see, you know, are there other bumps beneath this exclusion line that we saw? Or we start looking for alternative signals of electroweak symmetry breaking. But the search phase, if everything goes well and the machine doesn't blow up and the experiments work properly, then the search phase for the standard model Higgs should end this year. And that's quite exciting. So I'll stop here. I have conclusions, but I've said everything. Thank you.
A paper came out today, a heavy experiment, Tetratron's CDF, D0 of Plura, Z, combined with H. And the H goes into BB bar, the Z goes into pyramid forms.
Mm-hmm.
They see no excess there. It's 115, 150 GeV. In fact, there's a tick around 155 GeV. So, is this due to not being Higgs, or is it because of background?
I would need to look at that paper, because it's cool. You know, this is combining everything, all of their channels, Z, Z, W, W. So maybe this channel will show sees nothing, W sees some. The other thing also to realize here is they threw everything they had here, you know, multivariate analyses, et cetera, et cetera. So with photon, and four leptons, you know, it's hard for an experimentalist to screw up. So when you have those uncertainties, you have statistical, systematic, and if you screw up, we screw up systematic. Screw up systematic for this is not negligible. I mean, I'm not trying to bash these guys, because I know them and my friends are really good, but I'm also doing this type of analysis at Apple. So, you know, we worry. You know, you have your bottle of Pepto-Bismol. You scratch your head and you worry, am I doing everything right? And so they threw everything they had. So, you know, it's not a bump on top of a smooth background, which is why people want to see it. However, you know, their expected sensitivity with ZZ alone around 125, you know, is probably borderline. You don't see it because everything is there that the experiment. So it's normal, potentially, for one of the channels to fluctuate even below what you expect. I wouldn't say it's inconsistent.
Any other questions? Yeah.
So when you talk about look elsewhere effect, and for one experiment, it's understandable, but say you have two sensitive experiments pointing to an excess in the very same region.
Yeah.
It seems unfair to punish both by look elsewhere effect, because you can, you know, you can use the results of one to not have a very wide range for that.
Yeah, it's true. So then when you do the combination of the two experiments, by the way, they won't do it this time around. So we won't know, but you can estimate this once you combine the two experiments together. But no, it's true. Last December, you know, I was in D.C., maybe you were in D.C., and I listened to the talks at CERN. I did not know what CMS would show at all. I knew we had some bump at 135, so I wasn't looking at CERN. I was looking at there. And whatever excess they saw at that point, was willing to take the local p-value for that. It turns out, though, that, you know, because the resolution is so good, you know, 127 is not compatible with 123. So now we're sort of on the edge. They saw 124, we saw 126. It's not inconsistent, but it's hard to do in your head that way.
When you say that a certain range is excluded at some level of confidence, how do we interpret that? Does it mean that there's actually 5% chance that the Higgs is in that range? Or?
Yeah, essentially yes. So this is a convention, right? You can drive this up to 99.9. So it could be there, but once every 20 times we would get it wrong. So here I list the 99% confidence level. And here we exclude from 130 to 486 compared to 129. So you see that it's pretty steep here. Okay, so if you want to go to 0.9, maybe you lose a few GeV, but not more.
Yep. You said something about if you do find the Higgs, then you might be able to measure the coupling constant. Can you say a little more how that might, I mean, What would you look for to?
It's you look for two a production of two Higgses. So it's the triple coupling, Higgs going to Higgs.
Uh-huh.
And that's so the right now
but
this
you can't
week,
even see one.
Mm-hmm.
You can't even see one, no.
No, right, that's right. You can't even see one. And to see two is very challenging, but it's so what I was about to say is that there's a workshop right now going on at CERN, implications of what LHC finds for future accelerators. And that's one of the things that need to be answered is is there any hope of measuring two Higgses? You obviously need to go to very high luminosities. But since the Higgs is not that heavy, you basically are dealing with soft lepton, relatively soft lepton, soft neutrinos, and so if you want to go to high luminosity and have, say, we're talking for the super LHC, you know, hundreds of collisions per cross, we don't know if we can do it. We need to run simulations, design detectors that can do that. But answering this question is important because if the answer is no, and some of the people working on linear colliders would probably want that answer to be more. Because they would be the
thing. Yeah. So on a related note, if the Higgs is found at 125 with however many sigma you need, 5 or something,
mm-hmm.
is a Higgs factory in the future?
It's a good question. I don't know. I've heard in a few places that Japan would like to build such a factory, and they're seriously talking about it.
So would that be E plus E minus?
E plus E minus, yes, and not high energy. I think what I heard yesterday was 300 or 350 GeV. So something to go above, I think, twice the mass of the top or something. And so if there's interesting physics that's close to the TV scale, you don't have the right access. But you can produce. I don't know if it's really a Higgs factory. It's a maybe a Higgs precision measurement machine.
So you convince us that looking for the Higgs in WW is very challenging.
Mm.
How does CMS compare to the Atlas here?
It's about the same. We do sensitivities. So what you want to look, what we look as experimentalists is not the limit you set, but your expected limit, assuming that everybody's honest, and that tells you how well you're doing. And so we're doing that a little better than we are with our baseline analysis, but then they have multivariate techniques and more that where we get the same results. Our results are also consistent for WW with CMS. And one thing, I'm taking a bit of time here, but one thing that's really important also is for experimentalists to try to not look and not be biased by theoretical biases about what the other experiment is seeing or what other people are saying. When you produce a result like WW, you could have excluded it, so you got the 125, but we have a single at 125. And so, you know, what's your bias? You want to be, you know, will you say, I made a mistake because the Higgs is at 125? Or maybe you've just found, I don't know, some technical pion, and there's no Higgs boson. So you need to come in and just do your best job, and that's why we try to do things sort of as blind as we can.
If the Higgs were composite, would there be some hope of seeing it, or is it out of the question?
Well, what we're looking for is certainly not a composite Higgs. And if the Higgs is composite, yeah, we have searches.
You do have
for those kinds of.
Is there some exclusions for those?
Yes. I mean, what we're looking for. So one class of models involves essentially an extra generation of quarks. If you have, that's another thing I haven't mentioned, but a sequential generation of quarks with a Higgs boson is basically ruled out. That's one result that we get. So if you have a Higgs boson, you don't have a new generation. And the reason is, that, you know, in that top loop that I showed, if you've got something that's heavy and colored, it just blasts the production rate. So that's ruled out. What's not ruled out is that there is no fundamental Higgs at 125, but you have some composite object. And so we're looking for force generation in that context, so you could have some condensate.
But you say force generation is ruled out if the Higgs is fundamental?
Yes.
That's interesting.
Sorry, force is ruled out if?
If the Higgs is a, if you have a standard model, but you just wanted to add a fourth generation of quarks,
right,
of heavy quarks.
So don't you get into strong coupling? I mean, you have to have the new quarks are going to be pretty large.
Yeah, then you have issues, but you, I think the prediction that the cross section is large is robust. Maybe one of you can contribute. Might have, I don't know, you know, it depends what you put in the loop and what you cancel. So you have limits on Fermi and Fourier, so these are very tight.
Okay, last question, anyone? Well, maybe so. Let's thank Pierre again.